From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudet. The Sawtooth National Recreation Area is home to more than 700,000 acres of mountain peaks, 700 miles of trails, and more than 300 alpine lakes, all of this in central Idaho. And this month marks 50 years since the SNRA was formed by Congress. So this week, we're taking a look at the past, the present, and the future of this natural area. Rachel Cohen starts the series by asking this question. Why isn't the SNRA a national park?
It's 1960, and Frank Church is ready to make his pitch.
I want to talk to you briefly about Idaho Outdoors.
Church is 35 years old, and he's Idaho's junior senator, a Democrat, in his first term. He's in his D.C. office in a dark suit and tie, addressing his constituents in a crackly black and white film.
We have hardly begun to tap Idaho's potential as a summer playground.
Church wants to see Idaho become a tourism destination and says the path to making this happen is conservation of Idaho's unique attractions. Church stands up and points to a large framed photo of the Salmon River snaking through the Stanley Basin. The Sawtooth Mountains tower over.
I think there is no scenic grandeur anywhere in the United States to compare with the jagged summits of the Sawtooth.
Then Church says something Idahoans have heard before.
A national park there would preserve unspoiled for future generations.
At this point, all other western states have a national park. Yellowstone in Wyoming, Glacier in Montana, Zion in Utah. The Sawtooths were the homelands of a band of Shoshone known as the Sheep Eaters, who hunted and fished there seasonally. Beginning in 1911, many Idahoans pushed for a national park there, but miners, loggers, and ranchers did not want that. Still, Church was ready to be the new champion of the movement.
In the 60s and 70s, environmental protection, which included setting aside public lands, was very bipartisan.
Sarah Dant is a history professor at Weber State University in Utah who studied Church. She says he was a practical visionary, liberal in an increasingly conservative state. So when a federal study said the Sawtooths could either be a national park or another more modest option, a national recreation area, he introduced a bill for each.
To me, it's super smart politics.
Dant says he was giving people a choice, but a narrow one, sort of like how a parent might approach bedtime.
Do you want to go to bed now, or do you want to go to bed in 15 minutes?
Church was asking people how they wanted to protect the Sawtooths, not if. Church wanted a park, but he knew some powerful groups would oppose it because of what they would have to give up, hunting, grazing, and mining.
A national recreation area, on the other hand, would permit extensive multiple usage.
And it would still protect against what Church called unsightly development. Trailers and A-frames were popping up all over the Sawtooth Valley floor. Subdivisions were planned or growing near Obsidian and Pettit Lake. Church cared about what the people of Idaho preferred. So in 1966, the U.S. Senate Recreation Committee came to Sun Valley Resort to hold a hearing.
Next month, the Senate committee will come to Ketchum to hear Idaho citizens give their views on which of two plans can best protect, yet develop, our magnificent Sawtooth Mountain area.
Environmentalists testified a park would provide the best protection against things like mining, but most favored the recreation area. They included ranchers, county commissioners, and mountain guides. The Idaho legislature endorsed it too. Some saw it as the best option to stop the national park campaign. Church went back to Washington with this in mind.
Church understood very well that he was a representative of the people. And what Church wants may not necessarily be what Idaho wants.
He worked with Republican colleagues like Senator Len Jordan to build consensus for a recreation area. Their task actually got a bit easier a couple years later. In 1968, a Sarco mining company found a jackpot of molybdenum in the White Cloud Mountains southeast of Stanley. The metal was used as a steel alloy.
This could do terrible damage, permanent damage, to that high, fragile summit country.
The company planned an open pit mine at the base of Castle Peak, which soars nearly 12,000 feet. After an outcry from local environmentalists, Church and Jordan scrambled to include the White Clouds in their proposal. the threat of the mine had caught the attention of another Idaho politician. Cecil Andrus was running for governor as a Democrat, and he opposed the mine.
And we just flat said no.
His Republican opponent, Governor Don Samuelson, was for it. But the uproar against the mine got national attention. There was a New York Times Sunday editorial and an article in Life magazine. Many say protecting Castle Peak is what propelled Andrus ahead to win in 1970. The momentum also helped the Idaho delegation gain support for the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. It was not a national park, but Church felt it was what he could get done at the time. The act passed Congress and became law in 1972.
For me, a passage of this bill was especially gratifying, for it capped a personal effort of more than 12 years in the Senate.
It would protect the Sawtooth, Boulder, and White Cloud Mountains, and the valley that lies between.
But I always describe the Sawtooth NRA as being like a national park, only here people get to be part of the ecosystem. You can still cut timber, graze cows, hunt, fish, things that are really important to the people of Idaho.
Ed Kennedy worked for the SNRA for decades as a backcountry recreation manager. We're standing on the side of Highway 75 at the Bethune and Frank Church Galena Summit Overlook.
Just this amazing view of Snowy Side Peak and Mount Kramer and Decker Peak.
The expansive Sawtooth Valley is below. Kennedy says it could have been scattered with houses and commercial buildings like Sun Valley or Jackson Hole.
So you would see a lot more development here. It would look really completely different.
But he says he doesn't think something like the SNRA could be created today. He pointed to the Idaho House of Representatives shutting down a resolution to honor the 50-year anniversary this past legislative session. Some said it would be a celebration of federal control of what should be Idaho state lands. But to Idaho Congressman Mike Simpson, the work to protect the Sawtooths is worth celebrating.
Whether it was Frank Church or Jim McClure or Cecil Andrus, any of those people that did great work before us. So, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of a lot of giants.
He says people come to Idaho and live here because of places like the SNRA. Rachel Cohen, Boise State Public Radio News.
You can float down a world-class river, backpack into the wilderness, or fish in high alpine lakes in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. But while recreation is front and center in its name, it's not the area's only priority. In the second of her three-part series, Rachel Cohen looks at the soul of the SNRA, salmon.
On any given summer weekend, Redfish Lake might just be the most popular place in central Idaho. Matt and Gabby drove from Idaho Falls.
The sun keeps going behind this partly cloudy sky, and you know, it's keeping it under 80 degrees, so it's awesome.
This is our favorite part of Idaho, though, hands down.
They're part of the roughly 500,000 people who come to the Sawtooth National Recreation Area each year. Kirk Flanagan is the area ranger of the SNRA. He knows most people come for camping, hiking, and rafting, but he says the Forest Service has to manage it for multiple purposes, not just recreation. When Congress created the area 50 years ago, it handed the agency a specific law.
And ours, of course, is Public Law 92-400.
The law lays out the area's six key values: natural, scenic, historic, pastoral, fish, and wildlife. But the top priority?
You're in Section 2. It says the priorities for management of the Sawtooth NRA are 1, the protection and conservation of salmon and other fisheries.
Flanagan says that can be interpreted to mean salmon preservation is the centerpiece for the SNRA.
This is one of the most popular Chinook spawning areas.
Ed Kennedy is the former backcountry recreation manager for the SNRA. He's standing beside a stretch of the Salmon River, prime habitat for Chinook and sockeye salmon.
These fish didn't exist, and a science fiction writer wrote the story of what they actually do. People wouldn't believe it. They would say, nah.
The fish are born in cold mountain fresh water, Chinook in the riverbeds, sockeye in the alpine lakes, and then they float to sea more than 900 miles.
And then they spend 2, 3, 4, or even 5 years in the ocean. And then somehow, magically, they're maybe in the Gulf of Alaska, magically something tells them it's time to go home, something buried deep in their evolutionary DNA.
So they come all the way back and climb 6,500 feet in elevation to the farthest inland spawning grounds where they lay their eggs and shortly after die.
All of that nutrient composition in that salmon carcass becomes a part of this ecological process.
Daniel Stone is a policy analyst for the Shoshone-Bannock Tribe's Fish and Wildlife Department. He says those dead salmon are like a nutrient pump of nitrogen and phosphorus straight from the Pacific Ocean, feeding eagles, wolves, and lush meadows alike.
So everything that you see today was the product of tens and tens of thousands of years of salmon leaving the sawtooth, becoming large in the ocean, and coming back and dying on those stream beds.
The fish in the sawtooths sustain generations of Shoshone-Bannock people. Sockeye were once so plentiful, Redfish Lake would glow from their bright red bodies. But dams built in the early 1900s began blocking fish on their journeys. So by 1990, when the Shoshone-Bannock tribes petitioned for sockeye to be listed under the Endangered Species Act, no adults at all returned to redfish from the ocean.
If we lose our salmon, we lose the soul. They are the soul of the SNRA. They connect the SNRA to the greater world.
Doug Fenn owns White Otter Outdoor Adventures, running rafting trips on the Upper Salmon River. He was a guide for the company in the 90s when sockeye and later Chinook were listed.
As a guide, you recognize that we were seeing less and less fish every year.
The Forest Service introduced new rules to protect the fish. In late August, the guides would have to carry their boats out of the water at a few popular spawning sites. For much of September, the river closed. Fenn says this angered the original owners of the guiding companies because it effectively changed their seasons.
It just became the most cost-effective thing to shut down.
But he says businesses have since adjusted, tensions have eased, and river guides are often the ones who tell the salmon story to thousands of tourists who've never heard it before. As they're paddling through rapids, they talk about how the biggest threats to the fish in the SNRA are things like climate change and the dams.
We still have some of this pristine habitat where if fish were allowed to get back here in numbers, they'd actually thrive.
Idaho's Republican delegation and Governor Brad Little staunchly reject dam breaching. They say it would be really bad for Idaho's economy. But Congressman Mike Simpson has broken from the mold.
I tell people all the time, if you got a better idea, if you got a better way to save salmon, let me know.
Last year, he proposed taking out the dams while giving money to the industries that depend on them.
So far, nobody's come up with an idea because we have tried everything else. And we have spent $17 billion trying to get salmon past these dams. And guess what? Hasn't worked so far.
In the meantime, the Shoshone-Bannock tribes are working to make the Sawtooth Valley as hospitable as possible for the fish.
And every morning we'll come out here, we'll check the trap, do what we need to with the sockeye.
Rob Trahant is a Shoshone-Bannock tribal member and a senior fisheries technician.
Which may include pit tagging, fin clipping.
He's with Kurt Tardy, the sockeye recovery program manager, standing on the tribe's new research station at a creek flowing out of Pettit Lake, south of Redfish. It's called a weir, and it looks like a covered bridge that traps fish in boxes hanging in the water. The tribes use it to track the population. Idaho Fish and Game hatcheries release millions of young fish and eggs each year in lakes and streams. But Tardy says the tribe's focus is on wild salmon, adults that dig their own nests called reds and lay their eggs in the lake.
We want as much on-the-ground production in the lake as possible to allow that natural gene flow to occur over time to be able to create a distinguishable Pettit Lake stock.
Tardy says those fish have better survival rates than the hatchery ones. He'd like to eventually see all the alpine lakes in the basin naturally producing salmon. 2 years ago, a sockeye that was born in the lake and went to the ocean made it back to Pettit. It was the first time in 30 years that had happened. Trahant, who's worked on the recovery program all that time, released the fish himself.
My babies came home. I could say that, you know. Been here for so long that it's just nice to see fish coming back.
And last year, nearly 10,000 wild juveniles born in Pettit passed under the weir on their way to the ocean. If the return rate follows trends, 100 could come back next year.
It's very hopeful now.
As a tribal member, Trahant may never be able to fish for sockeye in the Stanley Basin in his lifetime, but maybe his grandkids will.
It's the future, right? That's what we want them back for.
Rachel Cohen, Boise State Public Radio News.
The Sawtooth National Recreation Area is mostly public land, but it does include about 20,000 private acres. And the Forest Service has the challenge of protecting the scenery and the wildlife while also respecting private land rights. In the final part of a three-part series, Rachel Cohen reports on what's often called Idaho's conservation experiment.
Emmy Blackman is walking around a marshy area on a stretch of the Salmon River.
I sit here and I just listen to the waterfall. Yeah.
Ducks swim across, beaver dams form cascading pools, and sandhill cranes stand observing. Blackman calls this Warm Creek, a refuge she envisioned with her late husband Fred, who bought the property. It's inside the boundaries of the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. Blackman, who's German, lives north of Ketchum, but likes being in her house by Warm Creek, especially in the mornings and evenings.
The fog lifts, or it sinks, depending on the weather. Then the mountain peaks appear one by one.
The SNRA was created in 1972, in part to halt development springing up left and right. There was hardly any local zoning at the time. Subdivisions were growing uncontrolled near Obsidian and Pettit Lake. Jim Snow is a retired lawyer for the Forest Service. He says the SNRA is distinct from a national park,
where the government just comes in and condemns everything and now owns it.
In fact, the whole idea was to keep private land in private ownership. That would preserve the Western ranching tradition and keep properties on the county tax base. The government just needed a way to stop the kind of development it didn't want.
So that's when we started adopting the concept of scenic easements.
Scenic or conservation easements are voluntary agreements between a property owner and a trust. Could be the government or a nonprofit, and the agreements limit how the owner can use the land to benefit the public, to protect the scenery or the wildlife or recreational access. Snow helped write some of them.
It's akin to a marriage without love and affection, because the government and the landowner are perpetual partners in ownership of this property.
The SNRA's formation came with a $19.8 million appropriation to buy into these deals with landowners.
This really hadn't been done before. It was kind of a grand experiment. Nobody really knew how to draft these easements.
Sharon Barnes, the private lands program manager for the SNRA, says the government needed to decide what rights it was going to buy.
And if you want to think about land rights as a bundle of sticks, you know, each one of those sticks represents something. One could be water rights. One could be the right to build roads. One could be the right to build houses.
Emmy Blackman's late husband sold a conservation easement to the Forest Service in 1986. She says he thought it was a good deal.
The government would reimburse you for the loss of value because you gave up your development rights.
He kept commercial development rights around natural hot springs on the property, but he gave up the ability to build more than two houses. By the area's 25th anniversary, the Forest Service had bought easements on about 86% of the private land. But it began to run out of money.
People would want to sell conservation easements to the United States, and they go, well, maybe next year we don't have any money.
So some landowners threatened to subdivide their land, and many worried all the money spent trying to protect the SNRA so far was for nothing. Last-minute funds from the federal budget in the mid-90s stopped some big construction projects. But lack of money wasn't the only thing threatening the system. Barnes says the original drafters were mostly concerned about small cabins and shacks. So the rule said no houses could be smaller than 750 square feet.
But they never said, well, you can't have a house that's not bigger than 7,500 square feet. I just don't think they could look into the crystal ball and see what was going to happen.
What happened was the easements created a scarcity of land that could be developed, and that drove values up. So Snow says while traditional ranch houses, even log cabins, were the initial goal.
If you go up Route 75 now, you'll see a lot of mega mansions. And I don't think a regular cattle farmer or rancher could afford to buy anything in the Sawtooth Valley today.
The second or third owners were often not the ones who had agreed to the easements.
And they don't necessarily feel the same way as those original landowners that made the agreements.
But they still had to live with the restrictions. That's resulted in a lot of lawsuits over the years. At 80 years old, Emmy Blackman worries about who would take over her property. Her easement says there can only be two houses, which she has, so the next owner couldn't build another one.
But they could remodel that and make it a bigger house.
She thinks that would change things. Blackman won an award from the Forest Service a few years ago for being a model private landowner.
It is something that you need to work to preserve.
Stanley residents are speaking out over an airstrip owned by...
Concerns over private land in the SNRA came to a head last year. Michael Boren, a Boise businessman who owns the Sawtooth Valley Ranch, asked Custer County for a conditional use permit for an airstrip on his property. Boren said the airstrip was really just an irrigated pasture, and the permit would allow emergency responders to land there. Critics who formed an opposition group disapproved because they said it detracted from the values of the SNRA, but the county approved the permit. Some people thought the Forest Service should have intervened more. It had paid more than $600,000 for a conservation easement on the property. But it was an early one, signed in 1974. Kirk Flanagan is the area ranger for the SNRA.
Some of those older easements are very, very gray and very little language on what they can and can't do. And that's the box that me as the area ranger, I live inside of that.
Barnes says she hopes the incident last summer helped people understand.
The entire Sawtooth Valley, the entire Sawtooth NRA, it's not all completely protected. That would have been a national park, and we don't have that.
Jim Snow, the former lawyer for the Forest Service, acknowledges there's some fragility baked into the easement system, with so many of them written decades ago. But he also says there's a lot to be grateful for.
We as a nation can take a great deal of pride that the people back then had the foresight to recognize that here's a resource that we got to save, and they did it.
He says shortly before retiring, he was standing on the overlook at Galena Summit, and he thought about how the valley looked almost as it did when he first visited. To him, it showed the experiment that is the Sawtooth National Recreation Area and the scenic easements that hold it together worked. Rachel Cohen, Boise State Public Radio News.
And Rachel is joining us now to talk more about her series on the Sawtooths. Rachel, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Gemma. Good to be here.
So, Rachel, you talked about how some people think of the Sawtooth National Recreation Area as sort of an experiment. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, I think it gets at why this area is unique. When the Idaho politicians were figuring out what to do with the Sawtooths, and they landed on this recreation area idea, they were sort of asking the question of, can we protect this place with some of the ideals of a national park, you know, to protect the scenery and to have opportunities for people to get out into nature while keeping things like ranching, logging, motorized sports. So they were sort of saying, can we do both? And the other part of that that's referred to as an experiment is the conservation easement system. And that it's kind of an extension of the same question, you know, can we have this space that's really for the public's benefit, but let individuals keep a large chunk of the land? And can we let that happen without infringing on the values that are important to the greater good?
So, you know, this idea of it being a recreation area instead of a national park, does anyone think that it should still be a national park?
You know, I'm sure there are people who do think that. I mean, I haven't talked to everyone who's visited, but chances right. are if you go up to someone at Redfish Lake and ask, hey, do you want this to be a national park? They might say, no way. And that's because we often associate national parks with crowds and fees. And a lot of people don't want this place to get discovered. And the flip side of that is that a lot of folks, including in the Forest Service, would say, we have been discovered, and actually visitation yeah. skyrocketed during the pandemic and nearly doubled between 2015 and 2020. And, you know, in the meantime, there are some struggles with managing that. So some people I talked to did wonder, you know, what would this look like as a national park? Would you see more resources dedicated to it? Would you see more protections for wildlife? But I think even those people who were willing to entertain those ideas tended to say what we have now is working pretty well. and it's something that they do want to celebrate and enjoy. And, you know, maybe there's a little bit of political reality baked in there, which is that, you know, a national park was not in the cards in the 70s, and that's likely even more true today.
So you mentioned the pandemic. I want to talk about that a little bit because, you know, I think everyone, we were all seeking opportunities to get outside and you know, get away from other people, right? So the Sawtooth National Recreation Area saw a huge spike in visitors. Can you talk, Rachel, about that? And what is the Forest Service approach to dealing with more people wanting to visit? Because I think back to the first time I went to Redfish Lake. I mean, I'm dating myself, but it was close to 20 years ago. And you could drive up on a Saturday, on a Sunday, and there really wouldn't be hardly anybody there. That is not the case, in particular in the summertime now.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And so the summer of 2020, the Forest Service, you know, the number of people visiting the SNRA was really not like anything the Forest Service had seen before. And if you went to the Sawtooth that year, you knew what that looked like. It was incredibly hard to find a campsite, even in dispersed camping areas. And the Forest Service was dealing with things like human waste that was not buried and campfires that people hadn't put completely out. And so there were a few changes because of that. The following year, you know, the agency shortened the number of days that you could stay at one site, and it mandated a bear storage order. And this summer, you know, the Forest Service thinks the number of visitors is a good bit lower than 2020, but there's no question the general trend is upward. And in the meantime, the Forest Service struggles with staffing. There are 19 people who work full-time for the SNRA.
Oh, wow.
And those are people who manage all the private lands, who take care of the recreational facilities. On top of that, there are seasonal fire staff. But basically, over the years, the number of employees who don't fight fires has really dwindled. It's about half it was 20 years ago. And so what that means is that there are a lot of partnerships with nonprofits, you know, to run the visitor center at Redfish Lake, to do trail maintenance. And the Forest Service says those partnerships are really important to getting the public involved and, you know, people engaged in protecting this place. But there's no question that those groups are doing some of the core work there because the Forest Service can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rachel, really appreciate your reporting on this. I mean, we are so lucky to have the SNRA literally in our backyard. So appreciate everything you taught us today.
Thank you, Gemma.
Absolutely. We have been speaking with our very own Rachel Cohen about her series on 50 years of the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. You can see some really great pictures that Rachel took in the SNRA. We're putting those on our website, so head over there and take a look at them, boisestatepublicradio.org.